I think the most annoying thing in life in general as an engineer is a run book that is not a living document. Run books that are PDFs or Word documents that can be downloaded and you don't know what the latest version is. Somebody leaves, you got an updated phone number, you got to send out a new version. Oh my gosh, are you kidding? During an outage, you want me to go through and try to find the latest version of a Word document? That's literally what we're asking people to do. I like my run books to be in a living document. GitLab, GitHub, Bitbucket, Confluence, pick your poison.
Welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. On this show, we interview leaders in IT operations, DevOps, and AI ops about the ever-changing world of running an organization's technology. With our guests, we dive into things like, what does it mean to run large-scale IT infrastructures? How do you manage globally distributed operations? What are the complexities of hybrid IT? How can you best leverage automation? And last, but definitely not least, how do you keep an eye on things using monitoring and observability? This podcast is produced by Tribe29, the company behind CheckMK, the software of choice when it comes to monitoring hybrid IT infrastructures. I'm Elias Volker, and I will be your host today.
So, welcome everybody. My guest today is Jeremy Proffitt. Jeremy describes himself as a technology firefighter, craftsman, and problem solver, builder of DevOps teams, husband, and family man. And I guess we see at least some of the technology and craftsmanship behind you in your background, which is really cool. And we'll dive into a few of these later in this talk. I think in your day job, your actual title is Director DevOps and SRE at Ally Financial. And you've also been a speaker at a number of tech conferences. I saw a video from AWS reInvent and Illuminate, which is, I think, a conference by Sumo Logic, if I'm not mistaken. Jeremy, welcome to the All Things Ops podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really exciting to be here.
All right, great. Glad to have you. Maybe to start us off, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into SRE and into DevOps?
Yeah, I've always been a geek. I've always been a fixer. Even from high school, I would fix things. That's what I enjoy doing. I had landed at LendingTree, just took a developer's gig there about 8 years ago. And one day we just had multiple things fail. And over the course of a week, everything fell apart. And I put together a list of what was wrong, where we had, issues, what we needed to do to remediate, how we could monitor them, how we could know about them. And our new CTO was, West Coast guy from Google. And he's like, Jeremy, I think we need to make you an SRE. And the rest is history. Right. We ended up doing all kinds of SRE stuff at LendingTree. And, observability went through the roof. And that was a really fun journey for me. And now I'm doing the same thing at Ally and really enjoying it.
All right. So what is your role at Ally and your team's role? What does it encompass?
So the division I'm in handles customer care and communication, which is chat, voice, customer service in general, and then the tools customer service uses, like the screen tools they use to look up your account information or help you change your address, stuff like that. And my job is specifically to ensure my team gives DevOps services, fixing Terraform issues, making sure, things are done properly and we're rolling out pipelines or upgrading and building out QA testing, all kinds of fun things. And then building the observability, right? We just got Datadog, so we're pushing things in there, changing over the APM, looking at metrics and building out dashboards and, all these things that need to be done on a system, much of it, not even a year or 2 years old. And it's just it's bringing that vision of what's going on, right, to the top, so we can figure out, you know, where our issues are and resolve them as quickly as possible, which is, I think, the part that a lot of people miss, right? How do you enable fixing stuff fast, right? So,
Yeah, that's what I always say when I do like product trainings for new salespeople is, you know, it's about sort of monitoring and observing, and it's about notifying and alerting, but ultimately it's about, you know, resolving right. and ideally avoiding future issues. So and this is like, to me, that's the trifecta of monitoring and observability. Ally Financial, I think, is almost a household name. What's the business of Ally? And it's a company that has actually been around for quite a long time. I think yes. almost a century or more than a century, although not under that name, right?
Yeah. So, you know, Ally's got a huge, there's a large amount of history behind Ally. Used to be GMAC and was a financial arm for auto loans. And, you know, beyond that, they've branched out to bank, to invest, to credit cards, to personal loans, financial services in general, right? And, you know, they're doing amazing work, right? And they just keep pushing the envelope. And it's you know, the best thing I think about it is when you work internally, it's just a really nice place to work. You know, we're actually interested in getting things done right. You know, we want to do things right. We want to be, you know, it's probably the most locked down laptop I've ever had. And I'm a director of DevOps, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't even have admin access to my laptop. And you look at it and that you're like, well, that is such a hard place to be in as a developer. But, you know, as somebody who looks at the business, you're like, wow, you know, they actually are putting in place a lot of the things that make a lot of sense from a security standpoint, from, you know, and it's just, it's really awesome to see them working on the inside. And, you know, and beyond that, it's just, everyone's so nice, you know, I don't have to battle with a lot of people. We have real conversations, you know, Jeremy, I don't think I can get these things done in time. Can we talk about a priority list? Can we talk about what you need done now and what we can do next quarter? You know, I mean, real conversations that make sense to have that oftentimes you're battling about, or people just look at a list and say, no, you know, we don't operate that way. And that's such a refreshing organization to be part of.
Okay. That's great. That's great to hear that. Now you'll have your applications pouring in after that endorsement. you mentioned it. I mean, the roots of Ally go way back, you know, GM subsidiary, more than 100 years. One thing that inevitably comes with longevity is technical debt. How do you think about a technical debt in an organization like yours?
You know, I'm a little bit different when it comes to tech debt. I have seen offices run in other financial places. Billing is a big one in county government, right? I know a number of them who still run on an AS/400. I know one that still runs on a System 36, right? Why? Well, because the system works for their needs, right? It does the business that needs to be done. Would we like to have faster, better, prettier systems? Yes, but at the end of the day, the job of like a tax office is to collect taxes, and to, if they can figure out a way to do that without having to spend, you know, a half $1 million on a new system and, you know, a couple $100,000 a year in support, by keeping that old system around that, by the way, works, why would you ever change it? And I think we miss that in business sometimes. Being as old as we are, we have mainframe, you know, are we moving stuff to the cloud? Sure. But we're doing it to enable feature set. We're doing it to enable reliability, or, you know, but we're certainly not doing it just because we want to move it, right? And by the way, if you think that's the wrong attitude, realize that like a Sun mainframe can have 200 processors in it And I challenge you to take a look at that versus, you know, a farm of servers. The only difference is everything's in one box and one mainframe versus a farm of servers. It's kind of the same thing. So, you know, we look at it and we're like, ah, Jeremy, I want to move this. I want to, you know, I want it to be in a Lambda. I want it to be this. I want it to be that. The question should be, is it fulfilling a business purpose? Is it secure? And if those things are yes and yes, why move it, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the coin, things that aren't secure, things that we can't secure, you know, things that aren't, you know, TLS 1.0 capable, right? We do have to move those. And sometimes it makes sense to rewrite them in order to put us in a place where we can add more features, right? COBOL programmers are difficult to find these days, but I can find a node developer, throwing that out, right? And so there's definitely advantages to doing it, but you don't always need to, right?
Yeah, COBOL programmers are worth their weight in gold, I think. Yeah, but this is actually something that I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about. It's like, you know, I think in the conversation that we had leading up to this, you mentioned an approach that I found very interesting, and also regarding tech debt. I mean, one thing what you mentioned is, you know, does it fulfill a business purpose? But you also talked about sort of how tech debt should be part of sort of the product process. And whenever productize something, it should be, you know, with the end in mind. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, you know, I've had really good success in my current role, almost being a product owner and taking a conversation both to our senior leadership and product and our Scrum Masters and delivery organization and saying, we need time on the books to perform these actions. And instead of begging, borrowing, and stealing time, which is often how we get tech debt done that needs to be done for security and stuff like that, we actually said, these are ticketed items. These are things that we need. We put a priority on them. You know, we put, you know, we swag them and we put them out there, and then we talk with the Scrum Masters, we talk with the TPOs, we talk with the APOs, and we go, how do we get this into your, how do we get this into your sprints? And especially when you're talking about large moves, like we're implementing a CI/CD process for Salesforce. That is not a small thing. And it requires a lot of training. And that's something that we've gone to that org and said, hey, we think we're going to need a whole sprint time just to train your team. We think we're going to need you to stop working for a week or two to do this. How do we do this? How do we ensure that we talk with product about delivering what needs to be done? We make sure we have time for everything and we don't end up missing a deadline. I mean, how awesome is that? Actually putting time on the books to handle things that need to be handled instead of that beg, borrow, and steal stuff. And by the way, then you have to fight with product and you have to define tech debt and you have to say, we want to do this. And they always ask, why? Because product loves to kill ideas, right? That's what they do. They root out what we really need. And some of my stuff has been DOA. And I'm okay with that because it gives you that conversation, right? And sometimes I'm surprised when I think something is tech debt and it gets prioritized lower than I think it should be. But, you know, it's when we all talk in a room about it, that's when we can really put the focus on what needs to go first and prioritize properly and get things out the door, right? Mm-hmm. So Jeremy's not always right. By the way, my wife will want a copy of that line for her phone.
Yeah. Well, she'll get a recording of this, and then she can quote you. So what it sounds like your approach is actually preferable to a conversation I had with a CTO a while back, and she was super proud that she had a dedicated team cleaning up tech debt, which I think is a very desirable thing to have. I think a lot of people would love that. On the other hand, I think it goes to sort of the risk of that you alluded to, that, you know, sometimes, you know, just changing stuff for the sake of changing it, because that's your job, you know, you're supposed to change stuff, whether it makes sense or not. Would you agree with that, or do you see it a bit differently?
You know, it can be difficult to get some teams to engage. I personally don't like setting the precedent that my team can develop, although most of them could dig in on pretty much any topic and do it. That's why they're in DevOps. On the flip side of that, I told my senior director, I want a dedicated node developer, and I just think it's a lot easier than trying to fight with the team sometimes. You can give me dedicated sprint resources. I'm okay with that. Some product owners prefer to think that way, and that helps them, and I'm okay with that. I think there's good parts back and forth. Honestly, the team building the code should own it. On the flip side, it should be written in such a way that I can drop somebody from my team in to fix something or remediate something. I just don't like the precedent that leaves, because then tech debt becomes something that Jeremy owns and not the team. And the team really should own tech debt for their own product.
Makes sense. I mean, you mentioned some of this already. Many financial institutions, especially if they're sort of as have been around as long as Ally has, are extremely hybrid when it comes to their IT. You know, you have your cutting edge cloud stuff, you know, everything running serverless with Lambda functions and whatnot. And then you have what you mentioned, you know, your mainframes running COBOL software. You say, and you just said this earlier, that that's not necessarily a bad thing. And I think I tend to agree. But how do you go about sort of monitoring such a diverse infrastructure? There's not the one tool to rule them all. Are you following sort of a best of breed approach?
You know, it's tough, because one of the biggest problems we have, and I think this answers a lot of that question, is we write a middleware application that integrates between SaaS applications and all of our backend systems. And that that middleware application contacts and reaches out to, you know, 15 different internal systems, and monitoring on them can be very, very good to, you know, not very good. And when my systems, my middleware starts to act up, is it the middleware or is it a downstream system? Making that determination, first off, provides the fastest way to remediate, getting to the root of the problem. If it's a downstream system, getting that team involved as fast as possible helps with remediation time. On the other hand, should I be monitoring those systems? Is that my responsibility? And do we set a bad precedent for doing that? And the answer I would give is very simply, I would want to know as an application engineer whether my application is causing a problem or whether downstream systems are causing a problem, personally for my sanity, but also because when we start engaging with DevOps or assets that are helping us on 24/7 rotation, being able to make that determination as fast as possible, that's how we reduce our, you know, mean time to resolution. Again, it's kind of a bad precedent to set. I shouldn't be monitoring other systems. I shouldn't be monitoring other vendors. I've even had other vendors being monitored that I called them and said, hey, your system response time is tenfold what it used to be. I think you're having a problem. And they say, well, you know, it's not a problem. We're okay. We're fine. It's working. Okay. An hour later, they're down. Right. And you're like, okay, I, you know, what, you know.
Hate to say I told you so.
I know, right? And you hate to do that. You really don't want to do that. But I think for our own sanity, we're getting into a place where microservices are so much of the world we depend on, that if we know that their monitoring isn't the best, I don't know that we don't have a responsibility to our own team, to my own sanity, right? To put that monitoring in place, even if it's just a synthetics check or, you know, some kind of very simple health check against them. It doesn't have to be for the smallest of minutiae of errors. The biggest thing I'm worried about is the, oh, crud, you're down. That's what I'm worried about facing. And if I can, that's easy to detect, right? So.
All right. And sort of to come back to the second part of that question is, you know, how do you go about it? I mean, do you have, you know, your one go-to tool? Do you use a plethora of tools?
Yeah.
How do you go about it?
So first off, I'm not a fan of in-house tooling. I'm not a fan of open source tooling run in-house because it's often run by one or two guys. When things go wrong, it's sometimes hard to get fixed. And you're basing your business on these two or three people, this one application, and it's monitoring the rest of your business. This is an area where I'd rather buy than build. That being said, I've used New Relic, I've used Datadog, I've used Sumo, I've used Splunk. They're all good tools. And I think you need an APM, whatever brand you want that to be. I think it's helpful if the APM is integrated with metrics and logs. You need a logging tool. I think metrics are important. And so, I like to wrap my things around with two layers. So CloudWatch alerts are always my favorite. They are cheap. They can be rolled out with infrastructure as code very easily, right? And then layer that with some Datadog or New Relic, log analytics, which you can, by the way, do in New Relic or Datadog, but, you know, I'm a Sumo guy at heart. It's just what I like. I live in a Splunk world right now, and that's okay too. So that's where I'm at for my tooling. Open source stuff is great, and a lot of these tools are built on it. I just don't know that I would trust an organization to, especially with staff, have somebody build out these things and then they leave and then something goes wrong. Now your whole monitoring layer is gone. And, you know, what happens when you log in and it doesn't work? How do you manage that? And how long is it going to take for somebody to fix it? So, yeah.
All right. Got it. So... what I hear you say is you have the sort of best of breed approach where you say, we have something for logs, we have something for metrics, we have something for state-based monitoring, whatever you want to call it. And part of it is, if we see this best of tool that is best used for certain applications. But, you seem to be very allergic to single points of failure. And that gum comes also for your monitoring and observability. How do you sort of handle the trade-off between having several systems, which makes the whole thing more reliable, and then having several systems that alert and drown people in words with the additional noise that creates.
Yeah. So when I look at how I bring people into problems, for me, the word of the day, right, is priority. Is it a P1? Is it a P2? I always want to look at P1 being production is down. I know it's down. There's no question. It's down, right? That to me is a P1. P2 is we think production could be down. We need to get people in there. Let's go. P3 is like, maybe there's something wrong. You know, P4 and P5 get into investigative or dev and non-prod systems. But if you think about how you route these to your people, you know, tooling like PagerDuty and OpsGenie provide us this ability to even have a P1 blow past my do not disturb, play some obscene, you know, music or, you know, and wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning, as it should for a P1. And then for a P5, we can have PagerDuty or OpsGenie not alert you until 9 o'clock next business day, or even just open a JIRA ticket for you and not send it to you at all. And then you've got a P5 investigatable object sitting in your backlog, you know? That to me is key.
But the other rule sorry that I'm interrupting you, but doesn't that shift the single point of failure from the monitoring system to the alerting tool that you're using, be it PagerDuty or ServiceNow or whatever you're using?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, these systems can and will go down. On the other hand, the cost to replace a DevOps engineer from my lens is anywhere between $50,000 and $100,000. By the time I hire them, pay a recruiting fee, get them onboarded, you know, lose time from my other staff, training this staff member, get them up and running, get them used to our systems. I don't know that I'm willing to sacrifice the sanity of my team or people in it, because PagerDuty might be down in an item that, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning is not working, you know, because PagerDuty's down or OpsGenie is down. I'm willing to take that business risk.
All right.
In light of losing my people, right? In light of having them walk off the job. And by the way, I've seen plenty of people do it. You know, you're not waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning again. Goodbye. Have a nice day.
I recently read a study on sort of the effect that the, and I actually wrote a blog post on this, and sort of the hidden cost of false positive alerts. So one is, yes, you need to investigate alerts that are not real. But the second is exactly what you're saying, you know, that you know, people get frustrated because, you know, imagine you wake up at 3 o'clock at night, you know, to take your example, and you know that there's a larger than 50% chance that this is a false alert. You do that once, you do that twice, but at some point you're like, you know, guys, this can't go on like this.
And the commitment we have to our team is that if something does come up at 3 o'clock in the morning and it's utterly BS, or it shouldn't have been alerted, or it's questionable as to the priority, the next day is when you fix that problem with your alerting. That is the commitment I have for my team. We will block everything else, because that sanity, and by the way, that commitment to having your team understand that you don't want to wake them up at 3 o'clock in the morning is just as important as not waking them up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you know, I don't know how you run a team any different, you know?
You'd be surprised. I mean, we see this a lot with our customers that, we've had stories of customers that had, you know, rates of false positive alerts, you know, 80-90%, which is, you know, incredibly high. If I put myself in their shoes and they say, like, you know, there's an 8 in 10 chance that this is totally bogus and I don't need to take a look at this, but I still need to, because for the 2 in 10 that it's actually a legit alert, that doesn't sound like fun.
Well, and two, I think there's a difference between something going down at 3 o'clock in the morning and something go down at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Let's face it, counting uptime in a 24-hour time cycle is like ludicrous in this day and age. Like, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's often much more important for us to go investigate things. And, you know, I'm willing for my people to say, well, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, PagerDuty was down. You know, we let it go for a couple extra hours, and I'll have the conversation with the executives and say, you know, look, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm not quite sure this is what I would call downtime. So, you know,
Well, unless you're really, you know, a global organization where it's always 3 o'clock in the afternoon somewhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, I hear what you're saying. Definitely. Yeah. All right. So, part of any ops discipline, be it IT ops or DevOps, is automation, you know, tools like Ansible, Terraform, Puppet, Chef, you name them. And whenever I hear about automation, I hear a lot about sort of automating the infrastructure itself, you know, the deployment and the provisioning and all of that. What about automation when it comes to monitoring and observability?
Oh, this is one of my favorite subjects.
That's why I'm asking.
Because I look at Datadog's and I look at New Relic. You know, when we purchased New Relic at LendingTree, the question I had is, does your system automatically go install itself on all the machines? If I give it AD permissions, can it go install itself automatically? Is this something you do? Can it SSH into boxes and install itself, you know? And the answer was no. And I'm like, what am I paying you for, right? It's the whole idea was just odd. We live in a world where we've got so much automation, especially in the cloud. I can iterate through EC2 instances with a call to AWS, get the list, walk them through one at a time. It knows what keys it's using for each of the boxes. I can put AD permissions in place. I can put users in place. There's a lot of different options, and I can install or build out things. And I don't even need to worry about permissions if I'm doing things like looking at a Lambda and pulling a list of my Lambdas and just for each Lambda putting in a CloudWatch alert saying that if there's 5 timeouts in the next 20 minutes, send a notice to this SMS or SNS that sends it to my email. The concept is so simple that the people who, I mean, we talk about infrastructure as code. We talk about hooking in that stuff with infrastructure as code. And that's great. But why don't I just use a couple tags to define how alerting works? And then just have a tool that goes in and just applies alerting to my entire stack as a standard. You know, we do that for security all the time. It just baffles me why that's not used much more in the industry. And by the way, it means that every AWS account gets monitored regardless of what you roll into it. Build it by hand, build it by infrastructure, CloudFormation, you know, Terraform, whatever you do, it just becomes monitored. Datadog and New Relic do this a little bit with metrics, but nowhere near what we can do if we do it, you know, roll it out ourselves.
Good. So, I mean, obviously, as a monitoring tool vendor, we know the problem of dynamic infrastructures. And I don't know, I saw a stat some time ago that 40% of all Docker containers live less than 10 minutes. So how do you monitor that? You can't go there physically, like manually install something on something that won't be there anymore in 10 minutes. But on the other hand, you might want to know, you know, that it's there and that while it's there, it's actually operating as it should. And, we believe that we have a good solution for that, but that might be a conversation for a different time. But yeah, these ephemeral infrastructures, that come and go. And obviously you don't want to, you know, your monitoring system to throw a fit if the Docker container or whatever, or the Kubernetes node or whatever isn't there anymore, but it's not supposed to be there anymore. So that's sort of the challenge that you face with these short-lived pieces of infrastructure. I mean, that's a challenge that we see that as a monitoring vendor. That's a challenge that our customers face. As I mentioned, I think we have a good solution to some of that problem. I mean, we as well haven't figured it out all, but that might be an offline conversation we can have about how we think about these things. But so, you know, we've talked now quite a bit having the infrastructure and keeping an eye on the infrastructure. I want to come back to one thing that we also talked about. It's actually running the infrastructure and, you know, knowing what to do when it goes down. And I know from our previous conversation that you're a huge fan of runbooks. You swear by them. How do you use them in your team? What have you found to be good practices? Maybe something that doesn't work as well?
Yeah, so I think the most annoying thing in life in general as an engineer is a runbook that is not a living document. Runbooks that are PDFs or Word documents that can be downloaded and you don't know what the latest version is. You know, somebody leaves, you got an updated phone number, you got to send out a new version. Oh my gosh, are you kidding? During an outage, you want me to go through and try to find the latest version of a Word document? That's literally what we're asking people to do. I like my runbooks to be in a living document. GitLab, GitHub, Bitbucket, Confluence, pick your poison, right? You got people on both sides of that conversation, but somewhere. And the other thing is, I see all the time people copying and pasting information in runbooks. We have links for a reason. Our runbooks exist under our PE organization, the organization that is 24/7 monitoring, pretty much like our NOC. And our runbooks live under their org. Why? Because it's easier for them. And for my team, it's a link. I just go to a link. I go to a bookmark. I know where it's at. I can access it. It's not a problem. And then anytime we're referencing architecture, it's a link back to our architecture documents. Why? Because I don't want, it's hard enough to get a development team to document. Asking them to duplicate that effort in two different places, are you insane? That's just asking for failure, right? Phone numbers, we put our Splunk queries in there. We put links to our Splunk and Datadog dashboards. We put all of that information in there, including, Splunk and Datadog dashboards and links to our downstream systems, because I don't want to just know when I'm down. I want to know when they're down or when we've got a downstream problem. But for me, having all of that information in one place, even if it's just a bunch of links, means that when there's an outage, I can go to a single destination. And the worst thing you can do when something is down is have to search through Confluence, especially for an organization as big as Ally, by the way. There's a lot of documentation out there, and it takes a while to get through it sometimes. And this is all speed. What our outages cost us, $5,000, $6,000 a minute sometimes, more, less,
The cost, especially for financial institutions, can be enormous. Remember a story from a hedge fund that I won't name now. They had an out. They had a direct link to the stock exchange they were trading on, and that one went down without anybody noticing for 7 minutes. And they were trading for 7 minutes on outdated data from the stock exchange. That cost them $1.2 million. So that's a. That's a few monitoring tools you can buy for that money. I know what you mean. I mean, outages and every minute counts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So, we're nearing the end of this conversation. We have these little, tongue-in-cheek, rapid-fire questions we ask everybody. And I think I have an impression that the first two will be quite interesting, especially the second one. So how old were you when you first started working or dabbling with computers?
10 or 11.
All right. And how old were you when you broke your first computer?
Oh, yeah, 10 or 11, right?
So that didn't take long. Do you remember what you did?
Most likely, I think the thing I remember most is trying to get a CGA card and a Hercules card together so that I could, and this is the fun part, have two monitors back in the, back in the 90s when I was a kid, right? So, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Now, you've mentioned that you're not a huge fan of completely open source monitoring tools, but nevertheless, you know, we're an open source company, so you know, open source or closed source?
You know, I like open source because when there's a problem, I like to go look at the software. I'm very much a, there's no better documentation than source code. That being said, I love open source. It's offered as a SaaS application.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Linux or Windows?
The hard one. For my servers, Linux. For my desktop, Windows.
Okay, okay. So try to have the best of both worlds. Or absolutely. Some people would violently disagree with what I just said, but you know, holy wars have been fought for less.
They like to run Windows for their servers?
Or Linux for the desktops. So,
exactly.
Seen it all. Now, I think I know the answer to this, but nevertheless, you might have a very differentiated view on this, actually. Cloud or on-premise?
You know, I love cloud. I really do. But there's times when, especially when you can do things like run ECS locally, on-prem and stuff like that, where there's really, I think, a missed opportunity to throw together, you know, 30 or 40 little cheap computers, you know, in somebody's den or a couple people's dens and run a hybrid cloud that does huge workloads that you can offload in a very predictable, very redeployable, very controllable manner like you can ECS off-prem and do it at a fraction of the cost of EC2. So I think there's definitely use cases for on-prem. But, you know, throwing together a website, yeah, cloud all the way, right? But there's still use cases out there where on-prem is good.
Yeah. Now, last one of these rapid-fire questions. On which camp do you fall, code or configure?
Code.
All right. Yeah, I was expecting that answer. All right. Code. Very good. Thank you for those. Do you have anybody who comes to your mind who should be our next podcast guest, and maybe why would they make a great guest?
You know, one of the inspiring people that I've had in the past is Paul Tima, who came from Google and, you know, was the CTO at LendingTree while I was there, is an adamant coder, which you don't often see in a CTO, would do code reviews and would have these talks about code in such a way that you're like, it makes you think, right? Would have conversations with the best of our developers, and we had some pretty heavy, really good developers. And you just start, it gets your brain thinking in so many different ways. And then to see him deal with the politics of everything going on as well as CTO. And, you know, having that conversation, you know, having conversations with him, he's one of my favorites in the tech, you know, in the tech world, and he's taught me a lot. So I think he'd be an awesome guest.
All right. Well, we'll try to reach out to him. Maybe you can facilitate an introduction or something like that. If you want to, you can directly address our audience. Anything besides making advertising for the great place you work for, and I know you're looking for constantly for people. Anything people can help you with?
I mean, I think the biggest message I would give my team, people out there, is, you know, I have so many times seen people who don't grow because they're worried about making a mistake. They're worried about, you know, what's going on. And I had a conversation with my engineer this week, and she is such a sweetheart, and she is such a beautiful person. But, you know, she sends me this note, and she's like, I sincerely apologize. And I'm like, the day I get her to say, Jeremy, I screwed this up, and this is what I'm going to do to fix it. The whole attitude, right? I want people to own what they do. I want them to own their mistake. I want them to own their triumphs. I want them to own it. And by the way, if you're not getting that and you're working in DevOps or development or technology, if you're not getting that at your job and your boss sucks, we're in an environment now, just find another job, turn on the beacon in LinkedIn and just go, right? Go until you find what you want. You know, don't sacrifice, just, you know, go for it. That's the biggest thing, right? And I like people who do that. I like people who say, Jeremy, you're wrong. I love it, right? That's my biggest advice for anybody nowadays, especially in the technology field.
All right. If you want to, for people to get in touch with you, where would be the best place to look?
Yeah. So you can find me on LinkedIn, right? Or just, you know, shoot me an email, profit, P-R-O-F-F-I-T-T dot Jeremy, J-E-R-E-M-Y at gmail.com. Pretty simple. Or you can look at me on GitHub, github.com/, you know, Jeremy Profit. Pretty easy. Yeah. So I'm really easy to find. Just reach out and happy to chat.
Great. Cool. Thank you so much. And we'll link to your GitHub profile and your LinkedIn profile in the show notes that people can find that easily. Jeremy, thank you so much. This has been a really interesting conversation. I really do like your take on many of these things. Thanks for taking the time for being our guest. And
appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely. Have yourself a great day. Hopefully we'll talk to you later.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Things Ops podcast. If you liked this episode, leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. This podcast has been brought to you by Tribe29, the CheckMK company. For more resources, head over to checkmk.com/podcast. If you want to send us feedback or suggest a guest, please drop us an email at podcast@checkmk.com. Until next time, happy monitoring.